Okay, tonight I'm going to be doing exactly the same thing insofar as the slides go that we've done the last couple of weeks, which is essentially nothing. We've got still completing now what is, at least according to Kyle and Delich, and I trust their observation now, what appears to be the second of three major discourses that Moses presents to the children of Israel on the plains of Moab. And as this title slide would show, off in the distance back over here. You can see the mountains of Moab, which are in Jordan, but it'd be back, just outside on the other side of these hills you see in the foreground, which are, and this is a great photograph, all of the remains of the city of Jericho. So this is where the Jews, of course, will immediately be coming, and we'll see, especially tonight, the urgency in what Moses is saying in chapters 25 and 26 about the imminence of their now crossing over and beginning to take this land. And so you see kind of simultaneously not just the ruins of Jericho, which is the oldest archaeological site on earth, or at least arguably so, and then the plains, as flat as they are, and then the mountains of Moab in the back. And then you've seen this slide also, three times I think before, but we just have these sundry laws that we're going to continue with in chapters 25 and 26. And so rather than trying to just, make up any kind of overheads here or slides, I've gone ahead and just will delineate for you as we go along what each law represents. So we want to start off tonight with chapter 25. We finished the first four verses last week, and we want to look at those verses 5 through 10. So grab your pencil, and Leviticus 25, 5 through 10, is just about, as far as the actual declaration of law goes, it's the only statement that we have with regard to Levirate law. That is spelled like Levi, L-E-V-I, and then rate, R-A-T-E. One word, pronounced Levirate, the Levirate law. That law exists, is named out of the Latin term levir, L-E-V-I-R, which means husband's brother. So in Latin, levir means husband's brother. And then, long after the Jews got this law, and we've gone through a couple of languages and translations, it now has come down to us in English as a translation of the Latin, levirate marriage, which has to do with the husband's brother. This reads like this in verses 5 through 10, the levirate law. When brothers live together, so let's stop there to begin with, this law did not apply to those that would find themselves in far-flung reaches of the world. It was a law that was designed for those that were living within the tribal lands as designated when Moses crosses over. Joshua then takes the land. Eventually they're going to receive their tribal allotments. And when they do, and you're living within those allotments, then this law would apply. As the centuries unfold, of course, Jews will be fanning out into many other places in what would eventually, by New Testament times, be the Roman world. And if they were a far distance away, then this law would not have applied to them. But when brothers, verse 5, live together, and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Now, actually, that applies a couple of italicized, and there are four words that do not appear in the original text. What it actually literally says is, the wife of the deceased shall not be outside to a strange man. Strange being outside those tribal boundaries. So, to continue in verse 5, her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. But if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall declare, thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And in Israel, his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. Now, needless to say, that, in our cultural way of thinking, of course, is about the weirdest thing you've ever read. You just see so many things wrong with that, you don't know hardly where to begin. And so we stand back from this and do the best we can, you know, to wear the moccasins and appreciate that these people lived in an entirely different societal structure than we do, or ever will, I suppose. Certainly not, at least as regards the biblical law, which is for Jews only. Here, which in Deuteronomy, Moses is repeating so emphatically as they go in to take their promised land, where many of these laws can only be practiced in that same land, as this one is the case. So, it establishes precedents also that are very confusing. It's against the law for any man to marry his brother's wife under normal circumstances. Even if the brother dies, you can't take her. But there's an exception. There's often exceptions to laws. And we need to remember not only the law, but the exceptions to those laws, and then, you know, apply them all. But back as a Jew, for Jews only, to preserve tribal identity in the time that Moses' law stood, which it hasn't for 2,000 years, then this was the case. Now, as you can imagine, I suppose that on quite a few occasions it wouldn't be just the brother who was disinterested. Now, how does it go in Pirates of the Caribbean? I'm not inclined to acquiesce, or I'm disinclined to acquiesce. You know that way. But, you know, she probably wouldn't be any, you know, more in favor of this thing either. But, you know, there also was a greater emphasis in their culture placed upon the family unit and the descendants from these family units. And so, in some occasions, as it stipulates, if this is not granted to this woman, she's going to be extremely upset about it. And so, while you're taking notes here, in your margin, you might just write Genesis 38. Genesis 38 is this law being practiced. This is the terrible chapter that has to do with Judah and Tamar. Tamar's in this circumstance. So Judah had two sons. One of them's dead. He sends the next one. He is unwilling to do this. And so God kills him because he's unwilling to do it. And then Judah does not grant her the third son. And so she, of course, is upset about it. One thing leads to another, and we get a lot of crossways, you know, with a lot of laws, it looks like to be. But, you know, Genesis 38 is all about dealing with these particular circumstances. Now, what's curious about that, of course, is that Genesis 38 is a long time before Moses. So apparently this law was being practiced and understood long before Moses codified it, or codified it, however you pronounce that word, I have heard it both ways, you know, in this written form. And so here, though, it's being established as a law on the books. That's the way it's supposed to be. Now, it has not only been sort of eye-crossingly strange for us, but it has been for the Jews as well throughout all the centuries. So I thought tonight, rather than trying to paraphrase all this myself, because it's not original with me anyway, I went to a website that I've resorted to on a number of occasions that's called MyJewishLearning.com. MyJewishLearning. So it's just one of numerous websites that are for Jews and explaining their own laws and their own history and that sort of thing. You can find lots of these online, and they're frequently quite helpful, at least from their traditional standpoint. So this will probably break the all-time record of my entire life for a lengthy reading, but I thought in this case I'd just go ahead and read this to you. So if you will, a few moments here. Levirate marriage is the obligation of a brother to marry the widow of his brother if he died without having sired children. Deuteronomy 25, 5 and 6. The corollary is that the widow must marry a brother-in-law rather than anyone outside the family. So we've just read both of those ideas in this text. Now it continues, the oldest of the surviving brothers had the first obligation, which also allowed him to inherit all of his dead brother's property. Now, as we look at this today, it doesn't say that in this law, but that is the way the Jews have traditionally practiced it. And obviously, there would be the question, well, what happens to the brother's property? And I've just married his wife. So apparently, I think most likely, the Jewish tradition here is probably correct. It probably been passed down, you know, from great antiquity, but at least that was their approach to it. Continuing then, next paragraph, the explicit purpose of this commandment was to have the surviving brother produce an heir to perpetuate the name of his dead brother so that it would not be blotted out of Israel. The literal meaning of the biblical text implies that the firstborn child of a levirate marriage would be named after the dead brother to carry on his memory. Levirate marriage was obligatory only on one who was alive at the time of the death of his childless brother. Now again, this is current Jewish thinking. I can't find anything like that in my Bible. But this is the way they've practiced it through the ages. Continuing, it did not apply to one born after his brother's death. Well, of course, there'd be a great age difference likely, you know, in those cases too, though still possible, but they just took that off the books. Next, continuing. Furthermore, both brothers must have the same father. If either of these conditions was not fulfilled, the childless widow was immediately free to marry anyone she chose. Now, at this point, I want to stop again and just say, we have just seen now, I think, four laws that the Jews have practiced for ages, but which have no reference in Scripture at all, do they? Yet, you can see how you would have needed to answer those questions. They're very practical, reasonable questions that would arise as various cases would arise. So I just thought it curious that while we have no biblical information, at least we do know traditionally how the Jews have been applying it. Continuing, the institution of levirate marriage also served to protect the wife. In numerous verses, the Torah lumps widows with orphans and strangers as the disenfranchised members of society to whom special kindness must be shown. Now, stop for comment again. You'll remember that we saw repeatedly throughout chapter 24 last week that became something of a chorus that these three, the widow, the orphan, and the stranger, you know, that lives among you. So, true, they are being singled out for special attention and care. So it's a protection to the wife and joins itself to God's overall view of wanting to protect those who are, through no fault of their own, now finding themselves in more difficult financial circumstances. So continuing now, the levirate law guaranteed her a new family, enhanced status, and financial resources. The most famous story about levirate marriage in the Bible is that of Tamar, who was an ancestor of King David in Genesis 38. After the death of his older two sons, who had both married her, Judah refused to allow his third son to perform this obligation with the childless Tamar. Eventually, Judah himself unknowingly fulfilled the commandment when he had relations with Tamar, and she subsequently gave birth to a child. As an alternative, now they say, and this I thought was particularly interesting because, again, it helps us with a fifth or sixth problem that's very obviously not addressed in Scripture. As an alternative, the surviving brother could perform chalitza, which is translated taking off the shoe. Now, this much we do have written, and we just read it, instead of the levirate marriage. If the brother-in-law refused to marry the childless widow, She would, in the presence of the elder, take off his shoe, a symbol of mourning, since his failure to perform levirate marriage meant that his brother was now irrevocably dead, even in name. She would then, it says, spit on the ground in front of him, indicating her contempt. Is that what the scripture said? No, it said spit in his face. So I don't know why the Jews now have changed that to spit on the ground, but they did. And then it says, she would spit on the ground, declaring, "Thus shall be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house." The widow was then free to marry anyone she chose. Whereas in the Torah, it is clear, do you know what Torah means? The first five books of Moses' law. Whereas in the Torah, it is clear that levirate marriage is approved. Well, yeah, we just read it. And chalitza is a shameful way out, which we also just read. The Talmud, which is a big collection of extra-biblical Jewish law, prefers the second, the chalitza, the taking off of the shoe. The rabbis believe that the brother should marry his sister-in-law only out of a sincere desire to perform the commandment and not for monetary, he is going to inherit all of the, his brother's wealth, or for sensual motives. Well, she might be a desirable woman. So they're addressing that, and then this excerpt I'll end here with the next sentence. However, they realize that such lofty thoughts are difficult except for, quote, the most elevated people. So as time has gone on, and in Israel today, to bring us right up to today, levirate marriage is actually forbidden by Israeli law today. So that nobody has been for a long time actually doing, those who claim to be Jews anyway, what we've just read in Deuteronomy 25. They just say, no, we're going to do this other way out, and it's shameful and embarrassing, but that's the way it's going to be, because we think the other apparently is even more shameful and embarrassing, so we're not going to have it. Rob was first.
Didn't that sort of play out with Ruth and Boaz? I think it mentioned that that was the custom of the day to remove his jewelry.
You got me on that one. It seems like, though, there was a different reason for the removing of the shoe there, but I can't recall now. So you're gonna have to look that one up. But I don't think what was involved there was a shameful act of somebody else's failure. But that's just what's hitting my brain at the second. Okay, Carol's next, and then.
In answer to Ron's statement, he had another person who was a closer relative to Ruth. And he had to decline the offer in order for Boaz to marry her.
Okay.
But my question is,
did it have the same shame attached to it? That's the part I don't recall.
Yeah. I don't remember it saying spitting.
I don't remember any of that either.
It referred to it as the custom of the day to remove one shoe. Yeah.
I know I've never taught Genesis here, so I haven't taught it in at least 7 years.
Whoever it was said that he was very happy to inherit all of her land, all of her husband's, or Naomi's husband's land. But then when he found out that this other woman was attached to it, then he didn't want to. So there might be something with cultures. But if the brother does marry and name the son after his brother, did you find anywhere where it said that the son now would inherit his brother's portion?
I'm presuming that he would, but again, I don't recall reading anything about it. That's why I've said so many times in Deuteronomy, it's really frustrating today, but I think was designed by God. This law cannot be practiced if you want it to, because it was only possible to practice in the beginning when they still had the original and then word of mouth plus prophets to explain how these things were supposed to work. But today there are so many questions on something like this, we don't even know how to answer them. It can't be done. So particularly in the Old Testament law, frequently you just have to say, well, I don't know on that one. It just has been explained.
Ruth 4:7 is what?
Pardon me?
Ruth 4:7 is what?
Okay, how does that read?
And then also in the first chapter verse 11, Naomi is talking to her daughters-in-law and kind of refers to it.
Okay, so, you know, it's all in the book of Ruth. But, again, it is a thing that hasn't been practiced by anybody now for millenniums. It's, you know, it's just over. So, unless you have another question, we'll pass on that then. And let's then turn to verse 11 and 12, which, again, we had occasion to talk about earlier, but this is where a woman touches another man's genitals during a fight. So, in 11, if two men, a man and his countrymen, are struggling together, and the wife of one comes near to deliver her husband from the hand of the one who is striking him, and puts out her hand and seizes his genitals, then you shall cut off her hand. You shall not show pity. Now, once again, this strikes us, you know, pretty strange thing, but again, these were the laws for the Jews. Whether or not that set them apart in a case like this from other cultures, or actually was just what the other cultures around them were also doing, I don't know. I haven't tried to research all this to see if we have, you know, supporting background material of any kind. So I'll leave you with that one. Okay, then comes 13 through 16. Now, this is an obvious thing, and it's come up before, and I'm just calling it fair measures. And while you're making your notes for fair measures, this is verses 13 through 16. Now, we've already seen this in our Leviticus studies. So please write down Leviticus 19, verses 35 through 37 says exactly the same thing, or essentially the same thing. So, obviously you should have fair measure. I'm just going to read it without comment. You shall not have in your bag differing weights, a large and a small. You shall not have in your house differing measures, a large and a small. You shall have a full and just weight. You shall have a full and just measure, that your days may be prolonged in the land which Yahweh your God gives you. For everyone who does these things, everyone who acts unjustly, is an abomination to the Lord your God. Now, I've added that one, of course, to my list of all the abominations I could find in the entire Old Testament. So I think you may find some of those pages that I printed out, you know, back in the back there. And if you'd like to see that, you can email me or something. But quite a long list, filled a whole page of these various abominations. But God cares about justice. He does not like to see anybody cheated. God rises up in a very righteous indignation against people breaking the law and making other people suffer for it. So here it's just, you know, to be understood, you'd expect that in financial dealings as well. Now, there's a very interesting one in verses 17 through 19, and this is the Amalekite curse. The Amalekite curse. They really messed up. So for your notes, they messed up in Exodus 17, verses 8 through 16, which I'll read to you. It's Exodus 17, verses 8 through 16. Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. Now remember, they're in the wilderness. They haven't even got to Mount Sinai yet here in 17th chapter. Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose men for us and go out, fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I'll station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur, that's H-U-R, went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed, and when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until sunset. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. But here's the salient part for Deuteronomy's sake. Now verses 14 through 16 in Exodus 17. The Lord said to Moses, "Write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and named it, "Yahweh is my banner." And he said, "Yahweh has sworn, Yahweh will have war against Amalek from generation to generation." So, in 14, you say to Moses, "Write this in a book." Well, here we find it written in the book. It's in Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 17 through 19. Remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out from Egypt, how he met you along the way and attacked among you all the stragglers at your rear. The only way you can know that happened is by reading Deuteronomy. It's not revealed when the event is first recorded. So he attacked you, you know, and all the stragglers at your rear. Who are the stragglers in any giant exodus like this? Who are they?
All the
young.
Yeah, they're all the elderly, the weak, and children, and sick, and, you know, can you imagine? And so God is just truly outraged that these people are being treated in this manner. They're not soldiers, they're not warriors. You don't do this. And it will bring upon Amalek, you know, a permanent curse. So it says so. Met you along the way, attacked among you the stragglers when you were faint and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore it shall come about when Yahweh your God has given you rest from all your surrounding enemies and the land which Yahweh your God gives you as an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget. So from then on, how was that for Amalekites? They just didn't stand a chance when it came to the Jews because they attacked the weak and helpless in that event. Okay, so that brings us to chapter 26. I think we'll be able to handle that pretty easily this evening. So we've really only got a couple of thoughts in 26. But they're a little bit difficult to understand. And here we go again. This is a law that cannot be practiced without living prophets and other judges, you know, that can determine some of these things. Now, it may be, it's not, you know, quite that difficult. I mean, we can see a lot of this. But, you know, I found it a struggle anyway. I had to resort to a number of commentaries to try to figure out what was happening here. But this is about tithing. Tithing isn't practiced in Christianity. Tithing is not enjoined upon Christians. But in chapter 26 and verse 1, it still was upon the Jews. Now read it carefully, and I think you'll come to the same conclusion I did, and then found this part confirmed in the commentaries at least. Then it shall be, when you enter the land which Yahweh your God gives you as an inheritance, and you possess it and live in it. Now I believe it's talking about the first year, which is very soon going to commence. We're going to cross over the Jordan. And we're talking about the first year. He says in verse 2, you shall take some of the first of all the produce of the ground, which you shall bring in from your land that Yahweh your God gives you. You shall put it in a basket and go to the place where Yahweh your God chooses to establish his name. Now, God will choose a number of places to establish his name through the years to come. Ultimately, it's going to be in Jerusalem. But I'm thinking that this part, you know, is their regular tithe that is then going to be eventually presented in Jerusalem each year. So, to read on, though, as I say, some of this is a little obscure, but take some of the first of the produce, first two of the ground, you shall bring in the basket, and then the place he chooses. Now, 3, you shall go to the priest who is in office at the time and say to him. Now, we're presuming here, too, this is not the high priest, or he wouldn't be able to do it. It would just be overwhelming, too many people. So, you know, it's a lower level of priest, a regular priest. You shall go to the priest who's in office at that time and say to him, and you have to recite these words. Think about this. You have to recite these words. What does it do to your mind when you are chanting this statement? I declare this day to Yahweh my God that I have entered the land which Yahweh swore to our fathers to give us. What does that call your mind back to? See, you see the prophets, you see the history, you see Moses, you see so many things that are encompassed by that, but you see how beholden you are to a God who gave this to you. Any sense, like Nebuchadnezzar would have so much later, about look at everything I did, is just being erased from these people's minds as they're doing this. And there'll be more about a similar thing in a moment. Then the priest, verse 4, shall take the basket from your hand and set it down before the altar of Yahweh your God. You shall answer and say before Yahweh your God, my father was a wandering Aramean, and he went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, but there he became a great, mighty, and populous nation. This is apparently, Bill asked me about this some time back, but this is apparently a reference to Judah again, or excuse me, Jacob, I guess it is, who became Israel and father of the 12 tribes, Jacob. And so it's not a reference to Abraham, I don't think. But it could be, because the original promise is in chapter 12 of Genesis, and it's to Abram, who will have his name changed to Abraham, father of many nations. But in this case, you know, maybe not, because don't think of Abraham as being an Aramean. But sure enough, Jacob spent all of his time way far north up in Aramea, remember? And then eventually makes his way down. He had to flee from his brother and wound up, you know, he had all that issue. So Jacob is appropriately referred to as an Aramean for having lived up there for a long time. But Abraham wasn't an Aramean. Abraham's from Ur of the Chaldees. So, Bill, you're free to comment now. And I know, like I said, you asked me about this before, and it's just another one of these confusing things, is who's this Aramean? Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, my text says Syrian, but the footnote says Aramean.
Correct. Yeah, Aramea is synonymous with Syria in the biblical records. So once again, that's not where Abraham came from. So we're looking for somebody other than Abraham. But let's continue. And so then it says in 5, let's just read that statement again. My father was a wandering Aramean, and he went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, but there he became a great, mighty, and populous nation. Well, it's going to fit again, because then we get the descendants and 12 tribes and Joseph, and they wind up in their captivity and all of that. So 6, the Egyptians treated us harshly and afflicted us and imposed hard labor on us. Then we cried out to Yahweh, the God of our fathers, and Yahweh heard our voice and saw our affliction and our toil and our oppression. And Yahweh brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and with great terror and with signs and wonders. And he's brought us to this place. He's given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now behold, I've brought the first of the produce of the ground, which you, O Yahweh, has given me. And you shall set it down before Yahweh your God and worship before Yahweh your God. And you and the Levite and the alien who is among you shall rejoice in all the good which Yahweh your God has given you and your household. So the first 11 verses of chapter 26 are, I think, the first tithe in the land. Now, the people are going to have to tithe year by year every year. But some of the commentators suspect that this was just the very first time and was not going to be repeated. Other tithes would take its place. Some say, no, this is the one, you know, that's going to be just continuing. And I don't know how to resolve that question. Partly it arises because after what is at least this first time, whether or not it's repeated, I guess is under some doubt. But this first time in these first 11 verses, we now have verses 12 through 15. Now let's read those. And then once again, I've got a commentary, different commentary that I pulled out to try to help straighten all this out. But 12 through 15. When you finished paying all the tithe of your increase in the third year, the year of tithing. Well, why is the third year called the year of tithing? And where else am I going to go to hear about this year of tithing that's somehow different than other tithes that are given? And again, I don't know where those passages are. I don't think they even exist. So here's why I'm so tentative tonight, is we've got these issues not easily resolved. This tithe, verse 12, it says, when you finish paying all the tithe of your increase in the third year, the year of tithing, then you shall give it to the Levite, to the stranger, to the orphan, and the widow. Well, there it is. Those three are constantly being cared for, so that they may eat in your towns and be satisfied. But it's only every third year. So it's problematic. Do they not get hungry on the first and second year, the fourth, fifth, or sixth? You know, what is this about? And there are other circumstances like the gleaning that we've studied last week that has to do, you know, with caring for them year round. So it's just an odd statement that now is so obscure that it's really hard to understand. But in the commentators, I read several, you know, they're thinking that what we're getting to is the seven-year sabbatical cycle. And now in verses 12 through 15, this thing only happens on the third year of each seven-year cycle. Let me read what they said. This scene would take place 2 years later when the Jews were supposed to bring the extra tithe to the local officers. The previous ceremony occurred only once. That's the first 11 verses. After the first harvest in the land. But this ceremony was repeated every third year. The seventh year would be the Sabbath year, and then the cycle started again. This confession was tantamount to a summary renewal of the covenant that Israel made at Sinai, their promise to obey the Lord and his promise to bless their obedience. The tithe of the third year was kept in the towns and used locally to feed the Levites, strangers, orphans, and widows. In giving this tithe, the worshiper was to confess to the Lord that he had been honest in setting aside the tithe and using it as the Lord commanded. He was not to take the tithe for his own personal use and certainly not to use it for any sinful purpose. He had been careful not to defile the tithe by touching it while he was unclean because of a death in the family. In other words, the setting aside of this tithe for others locally was a serious matter and had to be done with dignity and obedience. The ceremony would end with the prayer of verse 15, asking God to bless the whole nation and not just the individual worshiper. So, end quote. Well, now let's read it. Verses 12 through 15. When you have finished paying all the tithe of your increase in the third year, the year of tithing, then you shall give it to the Levite, to the stranger, to the orphan, and the widow, that they may eat it in your towns and be satisfied. And you shall say, once again, this kind of mantra has to be repeated. And once again, obviously, it calls your attention to the circumstances that made you the people that you are and the kind of people that you're to be. You shall say before Yahweh your God, I have removed the sacred portion from my house and also have given it to the Levite and the alien, the orphan and the widow, according to all your commandments which you have commanded me. I have not transgressed or forgotten any of your commandments. I have not eaten of it while mourning, nor have I removed any of it while I was unclean, nor offered any of it to the dead. I have listened to the voice of Yahweh my God. I have done according to all that you have commanded me. Look down from your holy habitation from heaven and bless your people Israel and the ground which you've given us, a land flowing with milk and honey, as you swore to our fathers. Now, brethren, I would that we had something like this today. I just think it would do us good to stand up once a year and make a confession like that one. That would, of course, be tailored for our Christian experience. But do you see how powerful that is? How focusing of the mind it is? How open and bare you are before Yahweh your God when you declare that you have both practiced and never forgotten any of His commandments. You have not defiled yourself in any way. You've not defiled the gifts that you offer to Him in any way. Can you imagine every year how that would focus your attention? If you were to read that statement today yourself, would that be a lie? Let's read it once more. This is something to be declaring in the presence of your God. So it starts here in verse 13. God, I have removed the sacred portion from my house. I have also given it to the Levite and the alien, the orphan and the widow, according to all your commandments which you've commanded me. I have not transgressed or forgotten any of your commandments. I've not eaten of it while mourning, nor have I removed any of it while I was unclean, or offered any of it to the dead. I've listened to the voice of Yahweh my God. I've done according to all that you have commanded me. Look down from your holy habitation, from heaven, and bless your people, Christians, and the ground which you've given us, by the way, a spiritual kingdom, a land flowing with milk and honey, as you swore to our fathers. Wow. Now, you know, rightly so, a lot of people have struggled with whether you can even take an oath in a court of law. This is quite a declaration. So these people were called, I believe, every third year to make a special tithe in addition to their regular ones. That's why I've said it's been calculated that as much as 50% of a year's income, all your income for a Jew, was dedicated to the Lord. When you add up the tithes, of which there's at least two, there's the first tithe, then there's a tithe of the 90% that remains, then there's this third year tithe, and then there's all your gifts and offerings when you sin, free will or otherwise. They think it's up to 50% that the Jews were giving. 50%! That's a lot for anybody at any time. But then you've got to stand there and make this confession. I'm thinking that would focus your attention to make a declaration like that before God. Bill.
Deuteronomy 14:28, I think, is the first mention of the third year sacrifice. I don't remember seeing it in the old law before that.
Bill is correct, and I'd forgotten that, Bill. You know, you're absolutely right. And I'm not sure if I had it written down in my Bible or in my other notes, but it rings a bell now. I remember that. And so, rightly, everybody, come back here now. Thank you, Bill, especially for this one. Deuteronomy 14:28. Here it is again. At the end of every third year, you shall bring out all the tithe of your produce in that year and deposit it in your town. The Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance among you, the alien, the orphan, the widow who are in your town, shall come and eat and be satisfied, that Yahweh your God may bless you in all the work of your hands which you do. So you're absolutely right. We've already seen this. And now, everybody, make sure you write that in at 25:12-15, so you don't publicly make the mistake I just did. It's embarrassing. That's Leviticus 14. Thank you, Bill. What was it? Verses 14:28 and following. That's why you do those notes. Okay, so it's, you know, a serious thing, but just amazingly important one as well, and it might do us, you know, good every so often to really just take stock. Am I really what, you know, everything that God wants me to be, and can I make a statement even at all remotely akin to that? Okay, I don't know who to go with first, so Jimmy, you first.
Don't we do that every Lord's Day to a certain degree between ourselves and God, when he says to have a cheerful heart, and we give what we prosper? So it isn't just a tenth, you don't think about that, but you think about what God has given you, and you want to give something back. So you, in essence, we're saying it every Lord's Day, aren't we?
Well, I hope so. See, that's exactly right. If you couldn't hear that on the tape, Jimmy's suggesting, you know, that with our offering and the information we have on it, 1 Corinthians 16, first couple of verses just to begin with, you know, that's essentially the same thing we're doing. Except that it's without this grand declaration. I haven't forgotten a single commandment. I haven't sinned. I haven't done, you know, wow! You know, so there's just a layer here of the vow, almost, that, you know, we don't do it when we give.
But we're supposed to examine our hearts, and we're basically doing it before God, so we have to be keeping His commandments and so on and so forth.
Yeah, Jimmy's absolutely right. You know, it is the heart is to be freely, willingly giving. And this was what these people were supposed to also be doing, with a focus on the fact, as that vow would say, that I know it all came from you. Okay, was there a Carol over here?
I was just going to say, this is another one of those commandments that don't tell you any exceptions, because what if you've done a whole bunch of sin offerings? You can't stand before the Lord and say, I haven't sinned, can you?
Well, yeah, no, I understand. And the focus, again, I'm trying to make a comparison to something, you know, it has a very limited focus. But you're absolutely right. I haven't defiled, you know, has to do with the sacrifice itself, hasn't been defiled in any way. So allow me this liberty then, you know, that you're right. And in your focus, that is what it's doing. I'm just trying to say, I wish we had more cognizance of who we are and what we're doing and how much we owe, you know, at the time that we go through these offerings of our own. Okay, Bill?
Well, Carol raises a question in my head. Are the Ten Commandments the only commandments that the Israelites have and the rest are laws?
Well, they're commandments. They're certainly all commandments. The Lord uses interchangeably, you know, statutes and covenants and just a whole bunch of words and law that all come down, you know, to the same thing. A lot of people have labored to try to find, you know, distinctions that really have a whole lot of weight and make big changes in how you think and act. But I just believe that's a big mistake. You know, every word that God utters is informational or else somehow binding. And so it's a commandment, you know, when he says thou shalt not or you shall, whether it's listed in the 10 or not. Okay, we got a few minutes. I think we'll finish, you know, with plenty of time, but let's go through the last part of this just to get it. Here then is apparently the close of what looks to be a second long discourse of Moses in creating this book, which he is first offering verbally to these people. They're assembling to hear every word that we're now reading. But now you have in 16 through the 19, the end of the chapter. This day, Yahweh your God commands you to do these statutes and ordinances. You shall therefore be careful to do them with all your heart and with all your soul. And we so often think of that phrase as being uniquely Christian, you know, and different than the law, but it's not at all. And so it's an old thing the Jews had known going back to Moses' day. Read 16 again. This day, Yahweh your God commands you to do these statutes and ordinances. You shall therefore be careful to do them with all your heart, with all your soul. So they couldn't get away with some doing it by rote and my heart's not really in it under the old law. So many times you hear people teach, you know, that was all about law keeping and there wasn't any heart involved in it until Christ comes. That's just not so at all. They were still intended to be the same virtuous people that we are and to have the same commitment to their God with a full heart and soul and mind and strength to add the others. So now 17. You have today declared Yahweh to be your God, and that you would walk in His ways and keep His statutes, His commandments, and His ordinances, and listen to His voice. And Yahweh has today declared you to be His people, a treasured possession, as He promised you, and that you should keep all His commandments, and that He shall set you high above all nations which He has made for praise, fame, and honor, and that you shall be a consecrated people to Yahweh your God, as He has spoken. Now, I've been pointing out repeatedly in Deuteronomy, starting with the fourth chapter, when you ask the question, were the Jews intended to be the light of the world or not? Almost universally in the old days, my answer, and most everybody's, I think, would have been, no, they weren't. They weren't supposed to be evangelistic. They weren't supposed to, you know, be anything but, you know, unto themselves. They were a separated people. It's kind of the way it's been taught or thought. But what does that sound like? Read 19 again. Set you high above all the nations which He has made for praise, fame, and honor, that you shall be a consecrated people to Yahweh your God as He has spoken. Their praise, their fame, and their honor, high above all other nations, was what? What is the praise they'll get? What is the fame they have? What is the honor that's been bestowed upon them? It's written in verse 19. You are the consecrated people to Yahweh your God as He has spoken. Those Jews were always intended to be the light of the world. They were to treat the alien living among them properly, to encourage that alien to see the superiority of Yahweh and His laws, His people, His virtue, His way of doing things. They were to be a light to the world in any way you can ever imagine. Now, they often failed at that. But there were times under leadership of men like David and Hezekiah and others where they were really getting the job done, getting it done really pretty well. So, as we bring this, the second discourse, to a close, we'll take up next week 27 through 30. Those chapters will be the third and final discourse, and then we'll see the preliminaries and the eventual death of Moses. But, you know, as we're moving into this, tonight I would just leave you with how sobering that is, how solemn that is, how very, you know, naked you would feel before God to make declarations like the one in that first tithe and then the one in that third year, and apparently repeating the third one every year, extensively making declarations about how you know God's law, you practice God's law, and you appreciate God for having given you everything that you have. Hopefully it might turn us even, you know, into more effective prayers. And then, as Jimmy's pointed out, you know, more focused and perhaps more global thinkers when we give of the contribution or partake of the Lord's Supper. But, you know, if you followed the law of Deuteronomy, you'd be quite a person. You'd be a pretty amazing person. Think of all the laws of Moses, what that makes you. Well, it would make you sin-free and exactly like Jesus Christ, and he proved it when he came to this earth and kept it. You would be exactly like Jesus Christ if you kept that law. And they were declaring every year, I know it, I won't forget it. Okay? Comment or question? All right. Close about 2 or 3 minutes early to